Hi, I'm Becky Parker Geist. I'm the host of the Audiobook Connection podcast, Behind the Scenes with the Creative Teams. I'm also president of Bay Area Independent Publishers Association and the founder and CEO of Pro Audio Voices and Amplify Audiobooks, providing audiobook and podcasting production, distribution, and marketing. And I'm really excited today to be here with Patrick McLaughlin, author of Cheerful Obedience, a novel. He served in the U.S. Army and was inducted into the Ohio Veterans Hall of Fame. He's also a retired fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers. Patrick, welcome.
Becky, thank you so much. I'm happy to be with you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing more about your book, your audiobook, your life. And in fact, let's start in. I always like to get a sense of go to the beginnings, you know, for folks. When you were growing up, did you grow up in the Midwest?
I did not. I was born in Texas. My dad was in the military. So he was in the Army Air Corps during the Second World War and was stationed in Monahans, Texas at the end of the war. And I was born there in 1946. And then we lived mostly in the South when I was growing up. So Georgia and Alabama. And we spent a year in Wiesbaden, Germany. And then when my dad initially retired in Orlando, Florida. And so, but it was midway through my junior year in high school that we came to Lakewood, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland. So, you know, been home since then.
Yeah. So I know a lot of times with military families, there's quite a bit of moving around and changing of schools for youngsters. Was that your situation as well?
Yeah, that's right. So in sixth grade, I went to a school in Warner Robins, Georgia. Seventh grade, Montgomery, Alabama. Eighth grade, Wiesbaden, Germany. Ninth grade, Winter Park, Florida. 10th grade, Orlando. And 11th grade, Lakewood, Ohio. So that gives you some indication of moving around.
Wow, that's amazing. And especially to someone like me who grew up in the same place, you know, lived my entire childhood and, you know, until I went off to college. So it's would have been a very different experience for me.
Well, and it's very different that for my three sons. You know, they've grown up here in Cleveland, the east side of Cleveland. They went to school with folks all the way from kindergarten, in some respects, through high school. The friends that I made over the years, sort of from year to year, I never saw them again. I never talked to them again. So it's a different way of growing up.
Yeah. And so your father was in the military and you joined the military fairly young. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was working during the day and going to school in the evening, and I was taking a minimum of 12 credit hours. And in 1965, this meant that I was deferred from the draft. I had what was called a 2S deferment. And so I soon became aware that the Vietnam War was going on, and I don't want to get into long stories, but I decided, look, I'm going to go in. My folks tried to dissuade me. They said, look, stay in college, get a degree, go in as an officer. But my mind was made up. So I went one day before school, I went down to my local draft board, walked in and said to the lady that I'm here to change my draft status. And she thought that I wanted to change it from 1A, which means immediately draftable, to something else so I wouldn't be drafted. And I said, no, I have a 2S and I want to change it to 1A. She said, well, if you do that, then you're going to be drafted right away. And I said, well, I understand that, but my mind's made up. So I did it. And they put my name at the top of the list. And I got my Uncle Sam Need You Boy letter soon thereafter. Yeah, but the reason I decided, Becky, to volunteer for the draft was because to enlist then in the Army or the Marine Corps was 3 years. In the Navy or the Air Force was four. But if you drafted, it's 2 years active duty, and it gave me the GI Bill, which I needed. And so it made sense to me. I'd serve my country during time of war and get the GI Bill to go along with it, assuming everything worked out okay while I was in the service.
Yeah. Now, fast forwarding to this point where now you came to a point where you decided to write this book, Cheerful Obedience. Tell us a little bit about what led up to that and what initiated that for you, that decision. Tell us about that.
Well, so my service in Vietnam and the manner in which Vietnam veterans were treated by the country, really disrespected by the country when I came home. And that stuck in my craw. And so I went to college after the Army, went to law school, you know, spent 10 and a half years with the Department of Justice, the last 4.5 as United States Attorney for the Northern District of Ohio. I was an appointee of President Reagan and went off in private practice and had a robust civil and white-collar criminal practice in the private sector. But always, through all those years, I started thinking about writing a book one day, and it was going to be about Vietnam. And then I started talking about writing a book one day. And so I retired some years ago from representing clients, even though I'm busy doing other things related to the law. And finally I said, you know what? I'm just going to write the darn book because I need to. I kept fussing about it. And so I needed this book to be authentic to my experience in Vietnam as an infantry grunt and to be authentic to the period of the war. So that period of 1967, 1968, late 66, 67, early 68. And that's what I've done. And I'm very pleased because the book is authentic, and that to me is very important.
Yeah. Now, had you kept journals and, you know, had you sort of tracked a diary of some kind, tracked what was going on a day-to-day basis while you were in the Army?
I did not. And, you know, I suppose if I'd have been smart, I'd have found some way to do that. But in the infantry, you got to remember, we lived most of our time out in the boonies, in the jungles and the rice paddies and whatever. And through the monsoon seasons, it was very difficult to keep anything like that because it was constantly soaked and it would end up being mildewed if you have it in some sort of container. But I didn't do that. I didn't have the presence of mind to do it. But I do have the letters that I sent home to my parents because my mother kept those letters. And some years later, she asked me if I wanted them. And I took them and put them in a shoebox and didn't look at them for a lot of years. And then, you know, finally took them out. So some of the time frame of the book is related to the letters I sent home, which indicated by date where I was, and then that refreshed my recollection in terms of the timeline. And so they helped in that respect.
Yeah. Is that where the stories came from? Was it from the referencing the letters?
No, not really. I used the letters only to help me, as they say, in terms of a timeline. So when it was in June of 1967, when we were Division Reaction Force and we had to go out and help sort of rescue a battalion that was in a very difficult situation. So it helped to pinpoint dates down and help me remember in my own mind where I was at a certain point in time. But the letters didn't help that much on detail because I didn't write about details to my parents. I wouldn't, you know, it just, those were not details that you write your mother about when you're off in a war. So in fact, as I look now at the letters, as I looked years later at them, I realized how vanilla they were in terms of, I mean, all hell was breaking loose, but you wouldn't know it from anything I wrote.
Right.
In those letters.
So that you were kind to your parents in that way. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the title of your book. You chose the title Cheerful Obedience. How did you decide on the title? What kind of process was that like for you in coming up with the title?
Well, I really appreciate that question. And I get it frequently because it's an unusual title for a book about infantrymen serving in Vietnam. Going back to the letters that my mother kept. So some years later, as I was looking at the letters, I saw that she had a couple letters that the Army had sent to her when I first went to basic training and then when I graduated from basic training and then from infantry, advanced infantry training. And I really hadn't seen those. And I was reading one day, and it was from a brigadier general who commanded sort of the training brigade that I was assigned to when I went to Fort Benning in July of 1966. And I read that letter, I read it again, I looked at it and I said, if I ever write a book one day the title of my book is in this letter. And if it's okay with you, I'm going to pull up my book because I talk about this in my book. And of course, here the letter goes to Mrs. McCall, who's the mother of Connor Patrick McCall, my main character. And this is what this letter dated in August of 66 from Brigadier General at Fort Benning. Dear Mrs. McCall, your son has arrived at Fort Benning, Georgia, to begin his military training in the U.S. Army Training Center, infantry. He is taking his place with the thousands of other young Americans in the most serious obligation and greatest privilege of citizenship, protecting our freedom. He will receive the best instruction possible. A trained soldier, physically, mentally, and morally sound, has a much better chance of survival in combat. Although his training will be rigorous and challenging, we are confident that he will successfully meet this challenge. We strive to instill the necessary discipline that results in cheerful obedience while preserving the individual initiative that is so characteristic of the American soldier. And those two words in that context, cheerful obedience, stood out to me, and I had to sort of laugh about it. Because, I mean, there wasn't much cheerful about it at the time, as I recall. but it fits right in terms of sort of the Army's expectation about how we form together and become a unit where we look out for one another and protect one another. And you do it obediently. And so there's an expectation, perhaps it might even be cheerfully obedient. And that's how the title came about, is from that letter to my mother.
It never even occurred to me that generals might send letters out. I assume that must be a form letter, but still.
Well, yes, it was. But I mean, there was a lot of angst at the time. Now, so in July of 66, I mean, combat troops started arriving in Vietnam and in the summer of 1965, and my division, the 1st Infantry Division, arrived then in July of 65. And then by the summer of 66, I mean, the casualties were growing. And so there's quite a bit of angst, you know, that was growing in America at that time. And of course, the casualties continued to grow in 67 and then into 68 and whatever. But I think it made sense for the Army to think about mothers and fathers, but mostly mothers in that context. And so I'm sure Mom felt some sense of maybe confidence that her son was in good hands, but
yeah.
Be that as it may.
Yeah. Did you feel that you were in good hands?
I felt that the training was, in the physical sense, was good. I prepared myself. You know, I was in good physical shape, and that paid off for me. Mentally, they look to break you down so you can become humbly a part of this unit until they sort of build you back up again. But what I understood when I finally got to Vietnam was that the training in both basic training and in advanced infantry training did not prepare us to fight in Vietnam. It was really more in 66, in that time period, relegated to sort of the World War II, maybe the Korean experience. And the Army had not yet caught up. There weren't enough guys coming back from Vietnam yet who had actually been there and experienced it so that the training doctrine and the training we received would really mesh with jungle fighting and you know what we experienced in Vietnam.
I'll just take a moment to say thank you for your service.
I appreciate it.
I know that's huge sacrifice. And so tell us a little bit about, like, once you decided, okay, I'm actually going to write this book, how long did that take, and what was your writing process like?
Well, I didn't have an author's discipline when I started, and so I did a lot of starts and stops, and I might write for a couple of days and then not do anything for weeks or maybe even months at a time. So probably it took me 2.5, maybe 3 years, I think, to write Cheerful Obedience. And then when I got towards the end, I was sort of getting into it and starting to move and starting to roll, and it came much easier for me. But, I wanted to be very attentive to the accuracy of of the calendar and the time frame about when things happened and as we move through. But a lot of it's from my recollection, and I guess it's properly called military factions. So it's a work of fiction based on actual events, and so that doesn't mean that everything in the book actually happened, but it's largely based on actual events.
Yeah, I'm curious if you had like buddies from your military service time that you were able to check in with about like memories that you had.
Well, Becky, that's a good question. And the answer is yes. So the guys I served with in Vietnam, we have annual reunions. We're called Dogface Charlie, or we were Charlie Company of the Dogface Battalion. And the Dogface Battalion of the 1st Infantry Division is associated with General Richard E. Cavazos, who's an Army legend and who was our battalion commander at the time. And don't get me started on the Fort Hood, Fort Cavazos stuff, because Fort Hood went from Hood to Cavazos, which I applauded and worked to get done. And then, of course, unfortunately, it's recently been changed back to Hood. But that's Dick Cavazos. And he was a great man. And but anyway, we meet once a year. And so, sure, I have those guys and I talk to them and I see, you know, men at the reunions who served in my squad. I was their squad leader in Vietnam. And yes, but it's interesting because as I talk to some of the guys about specific events, I realized that they just didn't remember, or they remembered things that I didn't. And after enough of that, in a frustrating way, I finally decided that, look, my name's on this book. I'm going to write it the way I remember it. I've got my letters. I've got after-action reports from some of the battles that are talked about. I mean, I've got the military stuff to go along with it. And so I'm going to write it from my memory. If there's something specific that a guy can help me with, I want it. But some guys had no recollection whatsoever. And so I decided I'm going to do it my way. And so, but that's that's a good question, insightful question.
Yeah. So now this is your debut novel, and you've sort of come out the gates with multiple book awards. Has that surprised you at all, this success?
You know, I'm going to have to give you a lawyer-like answer. Yes and
okay.
No.
Okay. I love lawyer answers.
As I refer to myself as a young struggling author publishing a debut novel, the answer is yes. I'm surprised that it's done so well in matching up against other sort of military fiction, historical fiction works like that in the genre that I published in, and it's done very well. Received a number of awards, and when we met in New Jersey at the banquet there, I received the book. Received the NYC Big Book Award, Military Fiction Book of the Year for 24, and then the Independent Press Award, Military Fiction Book of the Year for 25. And so yes, I guess I was surprised because I didn't have any sense of what it was going to be like and how my book would match up against others who were writing similarly. But then I'll have to say no, that to the extent that when I finished the book, and as I wrote throughout, I knew that it was authentic. And I knew that guys who were there that did what I did, they'd read it and say, yeah, that's it. This is what we did. They have their own individual experiences. Obviously, we all did. But they would say, yes, this is Vietnam and that period of time for sure. And that was very important to me. And so, you know, authenticity being the hallmark, I think, of a good book, certainly when you talk about this genre, I believe that it would resonate well, and it has. If you take a look at the ratings and reviews on Amazon and Goodreads, proud to say that, you know, it's carrying a 4.7 out of 5, and there's a lot of great stuff, a lot of complimentary stuff by people that have read the book, and I really appreciate that they've taken a moment or two to write something about it. So yeah, I mean, Yes and no, is my answer to your question.
Great, great. So as you think now, having written the book, published the book, as you think back on it, because I know that this can change as we're writing and then we're reflecting on what we've written and as we start to get feedback on it, what kinds of issues would you say your book addresses? And have any of those that you feel like it does address, any of those surprised you in any way to realize that those issues are in there?
Well, I hope that the reader comes away with a general sense that the men we sent to Vietnam to fight that war fought every bit as well and bravely under very difficult circumstances as the guys who fought in World War II and in Korea and the guys that have always served this country in uniform. And a lot of us were just kids. I mean, you know, I'm 20 years old when I'm a squad leader in Vietnam, and I'm responsible for 12 to 14 other guys, half of them younger than me, and right out of high school. You know, and there we are in Vietnam, having been sent over there, not really having been trained properly for that type of warfare, as I mentioned earlier. And our job is to serve our country, do what we're told, and make it home in one piece if we can. And so we fought for each other to do that. And so I hope that that comes across in the book. I mean, I think also what's going to come across a little bit, maybe towards the end too, is the fact that while we were there back home, protests were really starting to sort of heat up. When I went to Vietnam, leaving Cleveland, Ohio on December 31st of 1966, I don't really recall any of that. But when I got home 1 year later, as we landed in California and they were transporting us to a bus to take us to an Army depot, there were protesters out there carrying signs about us, talking about us. And it was like, you know, the guys on the bus were, what is this all about? And then, of course, it continued only to get louder. And certainly, there's good reason for people to have talked about some of the problems about Vietnam and why we were there. I mean, the truth of the matter is that our elected officials, you know, allowed us to sleepwalk into Vietnam and put a lot of guys' lives in danger for about a decade, you know, from the time of the Tonkin Gulf Resolution to when, at the end of April of 75, we were finally done, but our infantry, our combat troops were out 2 years earlier than that. But so 9 years with combat troops there. And so I think maybe some of that comes across, but the camaraderie and the brotherhood, I think, stand out. And it's authentic and unlike the nonsense that Hollywood put out in the Hollywood movies. I mean, you take Platoon, which is a great movie in so many ways. It was movie of the year, but it introduced America to sort of combat operations in Vietnam. And this was a unit of the 25th Infantry Division, and the area they operated in is the same area that we had operated into as well when we did some heavy fighting there. But they just, you know, and Oliver Stone is to blame for it. He was in the unit. I mean, he actually was a veteran in that unit. And I know this because I read the book by his company commander that said that Stone was a good soldier, but what he portrays in Platoon never happened. And I'm referring specifically to the violence, the rape and the killing of Vietnamese civilians. Two soldiers fighting, one soldier killing another. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie, but all of that is pushed in there. And so Americans walked out of the movie theaters saying, oh, my God, I mean, those guys over there are crazy. I mean, the stuff they were doing is unbelievable. They're criminals. And so many people in America sort of felt that, you know, we were baby killers. And the bottom line is, you know, we the people had sent us off to fight a war that we didn't start, and most of us couldn't vote in anyway. And so it was a very difficult time for the country and difficult time for the guys, but we did our job and did it well. So, I mean, I think that this comes out as a counterpoint to the Hollywood nonsense and the way they wanted to portray the American combat soldier and Marine. both.
Yeah.
In so many movies.
Now, as we step into thinking about the audiobook production process.
Yeah. So, I'm excited about that. Working with your people.
Yeah. We're excited about getting this, you know, brought to life in audio. And so I know that we're still early in the process at the time of this recording, but I would love to hear your thoughts, your impressions so far. Anything that has jumped out at you as something that was surprising in any way, or something that you think, it'd be great if other authors knew about, that this is a part of the experience. Anything that stands out at you so far?
Well, you know, I don't listen to audiobooks. Well, I have on a couple of occasions when my wife and I would travel, you know, back to Florida and whatever, and we'd listen to an audiobook. She would promote that in the car, and that was fine. She listens to audiobooks at home, but I never did. But looking at it from the standpoint of the reading public, I know that that's the fastest growing area of the reading industry, if that's the right term for it. And I just felt that Cheerful Obedience really deserves it, that the book has done so well. It's a legacy piece for me and my family. And so I really should make the investment to have an audiobook prepared. And so when I listened to you speak in New Jersey and you know, checked you out and checked out a lot of videos on the internet, that I felt that after doing some initial research before that, I felt that I wanted to go with you and with your people, and I don't have any regrets at all in having met Elias and some of you people and dealing with them. And I think one of the things that surprised me is when we had sort of our first planning session, I got the sense, and maybe this was just me, that maybe your guys felt that, well, I don't know how many, we're going to send it out to a lot of guys, but we don't know how many will then want to read about your book. You know, would want to read the excerpts from the book that I selected. And then lo and behold, when I got the excerpt, there were over 20. and I listened to everyone several times. And I mean, there were some there that were just really, really good. It was hard to make a decision. Because you had readers who were just very professional, and so I didn't know what to expect, but I'm not sure I expected that many guys would want to read about the Vietnam War, and so I was very pleased about that. And I picked a great guy, great voice, and so of course he's busy, which has set the timing back a little bit, and he's busy for a good reason because he's good at what he does. So. Yeah. So, you know, I've enjoyed that. And as you say, we're still, you know, early in the process, but I like what I see so far. And I think when I do have an audiobook, it's going to open up a whole new world for Cheerful Obedience.
Absolutely. And so going forward, like, what is your aspiration with a Cheerful Obedience going forward? Do you have any additional plans for it? Are you doing any other writing? Kind of what's coming up for you?
Yeah, I'm doing a sequel, and a woman by the name of Christine, who the book is dedicated to, my wife of 55 years, has reminded me on several occasions that I should have already published the sequel by now. And of course, she's right about that. So I am writing, but again, life gets in the way. I've just got distracted from some other things. I've got to get back to it, but I've got a great start, and I'm probably, 18,000 words in, and so, but I've got a ways to go yet. But so, yeah, there's going to be a sequel. So there'll be some of the same characters are going to come back. And I think that if I feel good about that, then perhaps a trilogy, maybe a third book, because we're going to have guys come back from Vietnam. They're going to go on in life and do other things. And obviously, my main character is going to go on to be a lawyer. And he's going to probably spend some time with the Department of Justice. And so, you know, we can get some law enforcement, maybe some thriller stuff in there. So it won't just be a military fiction. It'll be a fiction that transcends some genre there into some other areas. So that's what I'm thinking about right now. And so that's the plan.
Okay, so I'm sure our listeners are going to want to know how they can get notified when that next book is launching, and also when your audiobook is launching. Could you let them know where your website so they can keep up with you?
Well, Becky, I'm very proud of my website. I've got a great website. It's at pmmclaughlin.com, pmmclaughlin.com. But actually, anybody can Google cheerful obedience, you know, and Patrick McLaughlin, and about a dozen pages of stuff will pop up. And on the first page, you're directed to my website, so it's easy to find. And so I'll be alerting people, and I've asked folks to sign up, so people are signing up. And so I have their emails, and I have permission to do that. I can do the same with audiobook when it's published through you and your people. And of course, my own friends and colleagues and, you know, acquaintances and associates, I get the word out. But I'll try to advertise as well to get the word out on the audiobook, and I'm sure you can help me out in some of the ideas that I'll need to get involved in order to get it out, because, I mean, I'm serious about letting people know about it. And I have had a number of people say to me, is this an audiobook? And I said, no, it's not. And, you know, especially some of the older guys who will say to me, you know, my eyes aren't what, and unless I get an audiobook or a book that's with a big print book, then I can't read anymore. And the young people, I think they, I don't know if they read anymore. They listen.
Some
they
do.
Listen it's to a, everything.
It's a mix. Yeah. Yeah, it's a mix. Well, thank you, Patrick. It's so great in speaking with you. I want to remind our listeners that the best place to get Patrick's audiobook, Cheerful Obedience, is on Amplify Audiobooks, where it will be the best way to support Patrick as an author. So again, thank you, Patrick, for being with me today.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you so much.